And we are glad that you are with us. We did not expect the kind of support that you gave us, and you let us know that local media matters. Speaking of that, I invite you to check out our webpage. We've got news about the region that you can find out about, and that includes how the state agriculture department is receiving $11 million to expand innovative irrigation programs. And Larissa Donovan has a story about Northern Township that packed in to testify before a judge in a joint hearing. Northern Township wanting to annex away from the city of Bemidji. This has been an ongoing story that you're not going to find out about anywhere else. Check it out, KAXE.org. You can also sign up for the Season Watch newsletter. It's a great way to find out what to be looking for outside, what is blooming. Things are changing. We've heard from multiple people this week that lilacs are blooming again. More news is next. It's 6:01.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The government shutdown is now in its second day, and it's already having an impact on the real estate industry, especially in Florida and states where many lenders require homeowners to have flood insurance. NPR's Greg Allen reports the National Flood Insurance Program has stopped issuing new policies.
More than 4.5 million homes in the U.S. are covered under the Federal Flood Insurance Program, with the largest number of them in Florida, Louisiana, and Texas. The program's authorization lapsed with the government's shutdown, which means no new or revised policies can be issued. Tim Weishire, the president of the Florida Association of Realtors, says it's already holding up sales.
People that are right now maybe were planning to close on their property tomorrow or next week, they will be delayed, and there's a risk that they're delayed. And in truth, it can have a ripple effect across the country.
In the spring of 2010, when Congress allowed the program's authorization to lapse, the National Association of Realtors says it affected some 1,400 home sales every day. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Moms in America say they are dissatisfied with their health care. NPR's Katie Riddle reports that's according to a new report that exposes deficits in maternal care for women in the U.S.
The report is from the Harris Poll, who surveyed more than 2,000 women and explored disparities across prenatal, birth, and postpartum care in the United States. Among other findings, the researchers reported that over 3 in 5 respondents said they needed to fight for medical care, especially Black, Hispanic, and younger women. Mental health issues are increasingly reported during pregnancy and the postpartum period, and most women who are or have been pregnant also believe that maternity leave in the United States is insufficient. Currently, the U.S. does not have any federally mandated maternity leave. Researchers say their findings show that the current system is, quote, gravely failing to meet the needs of expectant mothers. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Israel has intercepted an aid flotilla of dozens of boats bound for Gaza as it got close to the enclave, boarding the vessels and detaining activists, including Greta Thunberg. The flotilla is trying to deliver much-needed aid to Gaza. UN spokesperson Stephane Dujarric says the UN is closely monitoring the situation and that the group welcomes advocacy in the humanitarian crisis.
We're obviously following the flotilla very closely. We do not want anyone to get hurt, and we want people's rights to be respected.
At least one of the 3 vessels taking part in the flotilla appear to still be sailing just off Gaza's coast this morning, according to the flotilla's online tracker. In a post on X, Israel's foreign ministry says several vessels were stopped and those on board were transferred to an Israeli port, saying they are all safe and healthy. U.S. futures contracts are trading in mixed territory this morning. You're listening to NPR News. More than 100 people gathered in a park in Grand Blanc last night for a vigil to remember victims of Sunday's deadly attack on a Mormon church in Michigan. Michigan Public's Steve Carmody has more.
Many people in Grand Blanc are still coming to terms with the attack that left 4 people dead and the church a smoldering ruin. Pastor Eric Stewart is the leader of a local Southern Baptist church. He told those at last night's vigil that the Lord is close to the brokenhearted.
It's very heartbreaking to think about evil and that transpired here, but let's turn our attention to the Lord, the one that can heal us, the one that can comfort us.
The investigation continues into the motives of the gunman, who was shot and killed by responding police officers after he set the Mormon chapel on fire. For NPR News, I'm Steve Carmody in Flint, Michigan.
A marine scientist from Mexico says a shark had his entire head in its mouth off the coast of Costa Rica. It happened last weekend as Mauricio Hoyos says he was tagging sharks for scientific research 123 feet below the surface when he spotted the shark and, using a pole, released a tag that hit the shark's dorsal fin. But the 48-year-old says the shark then rushed toward him, mouth open. He says as soon as the shark's teeth hit his skull, it released him and swam away, his scuba mask filled with blood. Hoyos rose to the surface and was hospitalized. He's awaiting jaw surgery, but he says he doesn't blame the shark. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Da, 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 da.
Start your day off on the right note with Morning Edition from NPR News. Listen every weekday.
Morning Edition begins at 5 a.m. Monday through Friday here on KAXE, people-powered radio for northern Minnesota. So many local conversations as well, like Area Voices and The Bright Spot and events up north. And programs that have been around forever that you, too, can sing along to, like The Sports Page and What's for Breakfast. Thanks for keeping us here. Get us into the future with your donation now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Keep us humming along.
It don't matter if you're tall.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep at WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll speak with a Virginia County supervisor about how the government shutdown is affecting his community. But first, let's get an update on the politics surrounding the shutdown. The White House seems to be using it to punish and pressure its opponents. Last night, the president called on Republicans to use the shutdown to, quote, clear out dead wood. He's also spoken of doing, quote, irreversible damage in ways that are, quote, bad for his fellow Americans.
The White House Budget Director Russ Vogt is making good on that promise. He announced the cancellation of $8 billion for energy projects in 16 states. All 16 are considered blue states. Vogt also canceled $18 billion in infrastructure funding for New York City. It's the home of Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer, although the cuts affect Democrats and Republicans alike, and some New York Republicans are objecting.
To talk this through, White House correspondent Franco Ordonez joins us now here in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
Okay, so Russ Vogt is not a household name for a lot of Americans, but he's perhaps the most influential person in Washington right now after the president. Just lay out what makes him so influential.
Yeah, I mean, he has the keys to the federal budget right now, and he's using that power to the fullest, or at least he's threatening to. And let's just remember that Vogt was also an architect of the controversial Project 2025 blueprint, where he advocated for a more activist approach to cutting spending and overhauling the federal workforce. And now he's part of the administration. I mean, this summer he told reporters at a Christian Science Monitor event that now, with Republicans in full control of the government, it was time to rein in spending, even if it meant doing so without the support of Democrats.
The appropriations process has to be less bipartisan.
Last week, though, he sent out a memo to federal agencies telling them to prepare for large-scale firings of federal workers if the government shut down. And as you can imagine, that really drew the ire of Democrats. In response, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries called Vogt a, quote, malignant political hack.
Now, we heard what we said earlier, that the president really has been making threats, right? That he's going to cut things and programs that Democrats like, but also that maybe some good could come out of this shutdown. So is choosing to do this now about curbing spending or inflicting pain on the Democrats so they'll budge?
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear. I mean, look, Congress has the power of the purse, but the Republican House Speaker, Mike Johnson, argues that its hands are tied because of the shutdown, and that that power essentially is shifted to the executive branch. Mm. Now, usually or tentatively, the government typically decides which employees are essential versus non-essential for a temporary shutdown. But in this case, the White House may be using that idea, that concept for permanent cuts.
But does the White House have that authority?
Well, I'll tell you, multiple federal worker unions say no, and they're suing. Bridget Dooling is a law professor at Ohio State University who worked at the OMB for over a decade. She says the shutdown does not give vote or the White House any extra powers, and thinking that it does is a misunderstanding of the differences between temporary lapses in appropriations, which is what a shutdown is, versus permanently laying off workers.
So this is a bluff, and this is the administration trying to use some leverage to basically force Democrats back to the table to negotiate to get the government back open.
Now, the White House is pushing Democrats to negotiate, but I'll say that based on votes, past statements, and his writings, he seems less focused on working with Democrats and more focused on making the cuts.
What does the White House say?
Well, I mean, the Vice President, J.D. Vance, he was at a press briefing yesterday. He blames Democrats for the shutdown, but says they have to do a little triage, and that means layoffs, which the White House says are imminent. But the White House never explained why layoffs were necessary and not temporary furloughs.
That's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thank you, Franco.
Thank you, Layla.
Let's turn to a community that roughly 80,000 federal employees call home. Fairfax County is located in the Commonwealth of Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., and Jeffrey McKay chairs the Fairfax Board of Supervisors there. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you. Good morning.
Must be hard to summarize, but what are some of the kinds of things those 80,000 constituents of yours do for the public?
Well, they do everything. They're air traffic controllers. They are scientists doing medical research. They are law enforcement officers, military personnel, you name it. When you have 80,000 people, they're playing about every role in the federal government you can imagine.
And I just want to note another thing. Fairfax County is suburban. There's expensive housing. There's less expensive housing. But I'm thinking generally cheaper than dead center Washington, D.C., because a federal worker is not making the absolute maximum money here.
That's right, which, of course, increases the vulnerability. The people that we're talking about that are being laid off are the ones that, you know, are struggling already to afford to live in an expensive region.
Okay, let's talk this through. And you have plenty of experience with shutdowns in Fairfax County. Are many of your constituents being told to stay home at this point?
Yes, they are. And, you know, of course, what we're all concerned about, to your point, having been through this before, is how long this will last. And so right now, we're hearing about people staying home. And what I am hearing from people is just anger and frustration and, of course, fear. But the real fear will come if this shutdown lasts for a prolonged period of time, which we all hope it won't.
What number of days would be prolonged in your mind?
Well, there's two numbers in my mind. One is, you know, 2 weeks for federal employees without pay is a long time when you're struggling to pay your mortgage. So 2 weeks for me is a long time for my constituents. For county operations, we're kind of paying attention to a different target, which is about 45 days. We know after about 45 days, we're going to see some major challenges economically with processing benefits for people and some of the things that we do as county government. And so, you know, I'm kind of watching on behalf of my constituents and then also watching on behalf of county operations.
When you said the number 45 days, I became a little alarmed, but I guess it's not impossible. The last one was well over 30 days, wasn't it?
It was. And we started to get, you know, started hitting the panic button right around 30 days, right around when things went back to normal. And so we're hoping that that doesn't happen. But, you know, every county has an exposure amount where they can continue to cover and help and provide assistance to people. But once that federal funding runs out, you know, obviously then you're looking at a whole different problem on your hands. And so for us, you know, we've looked at what that is, and we think anything over 45 days is, it will just be, have a terrible effect on families.
And I'm just thinking this through. I mean, there are people in America, all across America, who live effectively paycheck to paycheck. So after a couple of weeks, you're missing a paycheck, you've got an issue. What specific things are you able to do to prop people up if you need to?
Well, we have a coordinated services planning line, CSP in Fairfax County. We set this up. It became a nationwide model during the COVID pandemic where people can call to get assistance for, you know, from our nonprofit partners directly from the county. We know that people who are having challenges, either if they're SNAP or TANF beneficiaries or WIC beneficiaries, they can call through that number and get assistance. What we have done is set up a one phone number to make it easy on people. If you need help paying your utilities, you know, you need help with childcare, the types of things that really affect real families, they can call in on that one line. And what we will do is, you know, set them up with the appropriate resources, whether they're direct county, whether they're federal pass-through programs, or whether they are, you know, partners with our nonprofits that provide food support mm-hmm. and emergency services, that people can call that number for that type of support.
Let me ask about other aspect of this, because Russ Vogt is talking about laying people off. The administration has made it clear that they will target their fellow Americans if they're perceived to be Democrats or in blue states. In a few seconds, how seriously do you take that threat?
Based on what they've been doing, I take it very seriously. It's alarming. It should be alarming to any American. This should not be about politics. The people that we're talking about are performing vital services for people across this country. And the idea that they're being held hostage for a political fight is unacceptable.
Jeffrey McKay chairs the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors. Thanks very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Hundreds of actors, directors, musicians, and other entertainers say the federal government is trying to silence its critics. Now they're speaking up as a community. As NPR culture correspondent Anastasia Siulkas reports, they've relaunched a group from the 1940s to do so.
The Committee for the First Amendment first formed during the post-World War II Red Scare. In its initial incarnation, directors, actors, and musicians pushed back against the House Un-American Activities Committee, which accused many in Hollywood of being communists or sympathizers and derailed their careers. Their numbers included Lucille Ball, Ira Gershwin, Katharine Hepburn, and actor Henry Fonda. And now his daughter, the actor and activist Jane Fonda, is spearheading its revival.
We need to really understand what is authoritarianism. How does it rise? And how do we combat it?
That's Fonda on NPR's All Things Considered yesterday. She said the reformed group won't be doing just a bunch of stereotypical posturing and statement issuing. They intend to educate themselves.
We have to understand the ecology of what we're up against. And, you know, knowledge is power is the cliche, but it's true.
And then she said it's about using their talents as storytellers.
There's a lot of ideas that are brewing that I think are unique and will be fun. We're the entertainment industry, so we should be able to do that.
Anne Hathaway, Mark Ruffalo, Billie Eilish, and Spike Lee are among the nearly 600 entertainers to join this iteration of the Committee for the First Amendment. But it's not the only push towards more formal organizing in Hollywood. Last month, more than 400 celebrities co-signed a letter organized by the ACLU to support late-night host Jimmy Kimmel, whose show was suspended by ABC for nearly a week under pressure from the Trump administration. In both cases, the groups have said that defending free speech and free expression is not a partisan issue. Anastasia Tsiolkas, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 6:19. You're tuned into People Powered KAXE with Morning Edition and local conversations and stories like what's coming up next. I'm Heidi Holton. We'll talk with Jeff Sundin. It's our early bird fishing guide. We are going to be talking about the weather and the effects on fishing. It has been balmy, the right word? It's been hot, downright hot and unseasonably warm on this October 2nd, what we're looking at is increasing clouds. We do have a slight chance of some showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon today, but highs are 80 to 84. South winds 10 to 20. Slight chance of showers and thunderstorms continues tonight. Cloudy skies with temperatures 57 to 58 degrees. And fog early and partly cloudy to mostly sunny tomorrow with highs 82 to 85. Evening lows in the mid to upper 60s. By Saturday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 80s. Going on today in the Grand Rapids area or online, Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series. It's at noon today. This month, it's hydrologist Sarah Elliott talking about the ecological implications of forest fires on our water. You can register at itascawaters.org. And the Friends of the Brainerd Public Library have their big fall book sale. It is now through October 3rd at Westgate Mall from 10 to 6 each and every day.
Gone fishing. There's a sign upon your door.
Pops, don't blabbing around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. They each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with
you. Gone fishing. Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boys. You're bothering me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing,
bop-a, baby, bop-a, baby,
oh, yeah.
Time to talk fishing on Thursday mornings on People Powered KAXE. Jeff Sundin, our early bird fishing guide, is back. Hey, Jeff, thanks for being here.
Good morning. You're welcome.
So usually on October 1st, the weather is not affecting my work, but our air conditioning was out. So we're sweating yesterday here in the office and not expecting that. I can't imagine what this warm, hot weather has been like on the lakes and what it means for the fish.
Well, yesterday for us, luckily there was so much wind that the heat didn't enter into it. But the day before that, It was pretty warm. The last few days, in fact, I've actually been seeing people swimming. So I'm not sure why, but for some reason this year I'm getting an unusual amount of traffic over close to Bemidji. And also unknown to me why, but it seems like some of my favorite fishing spots happen to be right in front of where the swimming beaches are on these lakes. And so it almost had to be kind of an inside joke for a few days. But because of the places we've been fishing, we've been watching these swimming beaches, and they're quiet until about noon or so, and then 12:30, 1 o'clock, start to see people. So I'm sure on shore, you know, that temperature warms up and everybody gets rolling a little bit, and we've seen actually quite a few people using the water. The water temperatures are staying pretty warm depending on which lake you go to, upwards of 70 degrees in some areas. The lowest I've seen was yesterday when the wind was just really blasting. White caps were forming like practically right on the shoreline almost. And that mixing kind of took place, and maybe 64 and a half to 65 degrees was the kind of the water temperature. Now, if you contrast that with past seasons, the group of guys that I've been fishing with the last few days, the typical conversation that we have when they're up at this time of the year, I'm worried that the water temperature might be getting too cold. I'm watching it drop into the upper 50s or sometimes even into the mid 50s, and thinking about, oh, which day is it going to be when the lakes will kind of turn over and the fishing will stop being good and we'll enter into this, you know, kind of a late fall pattern rather than the mid-fall or the peak of the fall fishing. Now, this year, it would be pretty safe for me to say that we haven't even got to it. We're probably more like a late summer or a early fall fishing pattern right at the moment, something like that.
Yeah, we talked about kind of records and whether we were setting records with Tornado Bob earlier this week and in last week, and I don't think we've set the record, but this is so unusual.
Thinking that now somebody may know more than I do because it's kind of subjective which county you're in and you know the locale, but let's just use, if I just say the term north central Minnesota, as far back as I can remember, I don't think that we've ever made it out of the month of September without a hard frost. And I was trying to find some evidence that there had been one someplace, and I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I know we got down here in Grand Rapids, I think we got down to about 37 degrees a few weeks back, and that kind of looked like it was going to trigger the fall to start up. But I can't find anything colder than that, and I can't find anybody claiming that there was a hard frost yet. So I think whether there is such a thing as a record for that date, I'm pretty sure that we did get out of September without one, which is highly unusual. And the fish that we talked about this last week, too, the fish that had gone, kind of moved away from the shoreline areas and out into the open water. We had this little, the beginning of what looked like it was going to be the fall bite starting up. And then that just started to trickle out, just phased back in little by little. And now the rule of thumb for me over the past few days has been kind of like, if you no weeds, no fish. There's very few fish that are just out in the open for no reason. There's using the whatever weed cover they can find, and that's to be what's holding most of them right now.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit, since the weather is different, the water is warmer. How should we be catching those fish? What do you suggest?
Well, it's varying a little bit. Probably the main four presentations. Now, it depends on which species of fish you're looking for, because each one of there's a good number of the weeds between the colder weather that we got and the amount of wind that we got at the time. Some of the, like the northern milfoil, some of the filamentous algae and pond weed varieties that are kind of sensitive to, they're not very hardy. They don't last through those cold snaps. So there's a good amount of weeds that have disappeared. The wind has blown them up onto the shoreline and places where folks had gotten used to heavy weed growth a few weeks ago. Now lots of those weeds are gone. That's actually a good thing, because it's making it easier to get in and fish around them. But if you take perch, for example, they're showing a really strong reference or preference for wild celery or eelgrass, as it's called by some folks. This kind of looks like blades of grass that grow straight up and down. They have a root. You'll see it floating on the surface quite often. And it's about maybe a 2 foot long plant with a root structure. The grass is connected to a single root, and then let's say 20 to maybe 25 blades of grass coming from that. You see that type of vegetation, you're going to probably do all right looking for perch in that stuff. It's usually kind of shallow water, 3 feet down to about 7 or so. And fishing in that stuff with a jig and a minnow is not a bad way to catch perch at all. Now, there's some of the other weeds that we're still finding out there. Cabbage is probably the most durable of all weeds, and that will stay green and healthy even through the winter, is providing that there's not too much snow cover if the sun can get to it. So cabbage, and that type of weed right now is holding a little bit of everything. There's some pike, some largemouth bass, really nice largemouth bass are kind of holding in that deeper green cabbage weeds. A handful of walleyes are in that stuff. And then depending on what's in your lake, you might have some crappies or sunfish also using that. And the other main coontail, which is also pretty hardy, that stuff grows well into the fall and it stays green. And that's another plant that holds kind of a variety right now. But I've noticed that the thicker, the heavier patches of coontail, they're a little harder to fish through because it's so dense when your jig or your spinner, whatever, contacts that weed, it kind of gets hung up in there. And they can be so heavy at times that it's hard to fish through it. But we see a lot of northern pike forming around that kind of a heavy outside edges, the mats of those weeds. Wherever you get almost to the weed, there's probably going to be some pike located in that stuff. Now, all the weeds that I just mentioned, there's walleyes that are moving in and out of them, but I think right now the kind of program would be to get to that stuff early in the morning. We fished one of those lake with shallow flats like that and a lot of heavier weed growth a few days back. When we first got to the lake early in the morning, we could see fish activity on the surface. And as long as we could see fish moving around, we were able to catch quite a few walleyes. But as the sun got high in the sky, the walleyes sort of tucked back into the cover. The rest of the fish continued to bite, but the walleyes sort of disappeared. And then that same program was confirmed. I was talking to a fellow that was fishing on one of the lakes in the Bemidji area a couple days ago, and he kind of said the same thing. When he got there in the morning, he could see the fish on his graph. They were out moving around on the outside edges of the weeds, kind of along the drop-off where the water is a little clearer, and you see less vegetation. But there, too, when the sun got up high, he started having trouble catching those fish. The presentations seem like probably the best way to find fish right now is to troll with a spinner, and you could tip that spinner with a minnow or a night crawler, either one. As soon as you know where there's a few fish, though, we've been better off. You find them, okay, then you know where they are, then slow down. Jig and minnow has been probably the mainstay for zeroing in and being able to catch more fish. Now, if you're looking for panfish, crappies have been responsive to a jig with a plastic tail, a small 2-inch or even a 3-inch, a paddle tail, a twister tail, something as long as it's good and soft. There's plastics are divided up into a number of different categories. The better ones are expensive, but they work way better. It's your money ahead to buy a good one. Watch it fall through the water, and if you see that tail twirling and undulating and doing a lot of movement on its own, that is going to be really attractive to fish. Anything that's just like a straight tail, it kind of flips back and forth in the water, but it doesn't really have much motion. They kind of leave that stuff just go by and don't seem to be too interested in it. So use that for what it's worth, you know. And I've been adding a few little tips about what the brand names are and so on and so forth on the website, but I don't want to get too heavy into that. Just know that the better ones will provide better results than the less expensive generic kind of stuff. There is one other thing. If you've got the patience to do it, the wiggle worming is working too. It's a kind of a busy thing to do. When you finally do find some walleyes, they're responsive and they're biting on it. But along the way, you're going to get picked on by little perch and sunfish and kind of everything that's using those weed edges. So it's for people, like if you're a purist and you really love fishing with night crawlers, you're willing to put up with all that stuff. But sometimes a casual angler kind of loses interest in getting picked on by the smaller fish. So take that with a grain of salt. If you're really interested in avoiding anything little and you just want to catch larger fish, you're into walleyes and pike, and that's all that's going to make you happy. We've been having some pretty good luck using larger minnows. Something in the, let's say, 5 to 7 inch size range, maybe a little bit larger if you're interested in northern pike, but you want it to be lively. We use a little bit larger than average hook on a Lindy rig, just a simple Lindy rig, 6 foot long leader with about a 1/0 hook on it. And we're hooking the minnows just through the very outside upper lip. You don't want to use both lips. You want to be able to keep that minnow alive, and they need to be able to move their mouth to get oxygen through their gills. So just hook that upper lip and let them swim lively. If it's not swimming, then you have to get rid of it and use a new minnow, because the minnow literally is doing all the work. The presentation is real simple. Lower your sinker to the bottom. Move slowly along the drop-off or along the weed edges. Let the bait do everything. And we've had, now most of those walleyes that we're catching, especially if we fish on lakes that have slot limits like Winnie or wherever, most of the fish that we're catching on that presentation are perfect for taking a picture and releasing, but you're not going to catch a lot of eating-sized fish using that presentation. And kind of the same is true. Northerns, you'll get a few more fish that are in the keeper range, and a lot of my folks like those. So northerns are a bonus a lot of times for me. And if they are to you, then this is another program that will work for them.
So, Jeff, when it comes to bait, a lot of the stories coming out of Morning Edition today are about rising costs, and people are making different plans for travel because costs are up. Is bait rising, too, in terms of price?
Bait is very expensive compared to what it used to be, and the alternatives are also expensive. You know, some of these plastic tails that I mentioned, the ones that I've been using, yeah, you might be looking at a package of 5 that are $7 or $8. So, you know, a couple bucks a piece. Minnows, especially if you can find the right ones, if you can get a good size shiner or a red tail or creek chubs, these are also very expensive. You know, a typical shiners we don't see quite as much this time of year, but in the spring, you know, you're looking at a minnow that's $1 a piece. So you want to use them sparingly. And I think that observation, folks are not, they're not traveling necessarily less, but they're rethinking where they want to travel.
Mm-hmm.
If in the days when walleye fishing was really, really great, let's say in the past few years, we sort of got spoiled on Winnie. There was that gigantic year class of fish from 2018 and again in 2019. So for a few years after that, fishing was pretty darn good, and folks had a pretty high expectation. If they got to that lake, they were going to catch something. So the traffic sort of ramped up, and you could see a lot more people fishing on the lake. Now, those year classes of fish have been worked down a little bit. The next new one that's coming up is sort of getting there, but it's not quite there. So a lot of these same folks now, they're not going to just get in the truck and go to see if they're biting. They're going to wait until they hear from somebody. So their uncle Ernie says, yeah, they're biting. You better get up here right now because they're biting. Those folks are traveling. They'll go to the lake. But folks that are just experimenting or going out to check to see if their favorite lake is kind of like, quote unquote, if the bite is on yet or not, they're hanging back. They're not, we're not seeing a lot of those folks out on the lake. And some of the larger lakes, like Winnie, for example, you get out there, every resort on the lake can be filled up. But when you get all those boats on the lake, there's a lot of space out there, so they don't really form any kind of a big crowd anyplace. And so it looks, the appearance is that things are really quiet out there. And I think part of that is just, it's very expensive to get out there and prepare yourself. So the folks will do it, but they're going to do it when they think it's the best time to do it.
Yeah. Before we go, let's talk about the season is starting of DNR meetings where people can learn a lot about a lot of different topics.
It is. I'm checking my emails, and I think I mentioned a couple weeks ago I got myself volunteered into a third group now. So I'm on the technology work group and on the panfish work group. And now the newly formed Lake Winnebagoche work group, and that meeting is coming up in a few weeks. And then the others are within days after that. So, folks, I'm pretty easy to figure out how to get in touch with me. And if you have some questions along the lines, comments on anything, the forward-facing sonar is going to be a hot topic again this fall as these meetings start up. So is the perch population across Minnesota has been a topic of concern, and the panfish work group is going to be taking up a lot of conversation about jumbo perch throughout the course of this winter. And as always, walleyes are really important. That's going to come up on the Winnie work group and some of the things that are going to be of concern. The DNR, the top officials, for some reason, are sort of sitting on whether they're going to make an announcement about the four walleye limit. They say that they're going to, that it's going to be coming along here pretty soon, but nobody has really seen an official version of it. So I'm sure that topic is going to come up at the Winnie meetings, along with some other things concerning walleye, perch, pike, and et cetera. So if you got a little concern or a question, now's the time to start feeding them over, because the DNR forms these groups because they want to hear what people have on their mind. Don't think for a second that they don't care what your opinion is. You just have to stand up and say it.
That's Jeff Sundin. You can find his contact information, his fishing reports, at jeffsundin.com. Have a great day. We'll check in next week.
All right. Thank you. We'll see you.
See you, Jeff. Coming up, we'll hear from National Native News. Dan Karpinchuk has the story about how across Canada, Indigenous and non-Indigenous people have marked the fifth National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. It's also known as Orange Shirt Day. We'll learn more about that, about the how the Prime Minister has reflected on the tragic legacy of the residential school system and talked about how his government is moving towards reconciliation. Stay tuned for that. We'd like to thank Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Across Canada, people mark the fifth National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, also known as Orange Shirt Day. Prime Minister Mark Carney reflected on the tragic legacy of the residential school system and talked about how his government is moving toward reconciliation. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, the country's governor general says more work remains.
There were rallies, ceremonies, and speeches with, in many communities, a sea of orange shirts. And there were celebrations of Indigenous music, language, art, and culture. And most importantly, there was time to reflect on the past abuses of the residential schools. In Ottawa, at one of the events, Prime Minister Mark Carney addressed the crowd.
Truth is the foundation of justice. And the truth is, for more than a century, this country ran residential schools. Over 150,000 First Nations, Inuit, and Métis children were taken from their families and their communities, torn from their languages, their cultures, and their identities. On this National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, we honor survivors and the children who never returned home. We reflect on the devastating legacy of the residential school system. And we, as a government and as a people, we match remembrance with responsibility.
It's been nearly 10 years since the recommendations from the National Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There were 94 directives after hearing from thousands of residential school survivors who told their personal stories of pain and tragedy. Carney says his government remains committed to advancing the work of that commission. Governor General Mary Simon, who is Indigenous, says some progress has taken place, but much work remains.
Inequities persist, and we share a lifelong responsibility to address them. I have seen Indigenous people striving to heal while still struggling to meet basic needs. Too often, they lack access to adequate trauma-informed mental health support that honors their traditional healing practices. So today, I call on every Canadian to renew their commitment to reconciliation.
Simon says she sees a world where young Indigenous people can embrace being Canadian without compromising their identity. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
In the U.S., Orange Shirt Day events also took place, including at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas. The university was originally established as an Indian boarding school. Current Haskell senior Denise Flores Frazier gave out ribbons in remembrance of children who attended the Haskell Institute and never returned home.
We created pins with the names of each 150 children that were discovered here at Haskell Indian Nations University. We put out their tribes and a little website link so that people can find if they have a relative here or if they just wanted to know more information about some of the children here, like the ages that they passed or their time here at Haskell. We're also leaving notes so that they can write letters to them. They won't be left at the graveyard, and we're not reading them. We're just collecting them in case people have anything they want to say to the children.
The sorority chapter of Gamma Delta Pi hosted the event. Other events on campus included a remembrance walk and an open mic and panel night to provide people the opportunity to share stories. The National Congress of American Indians has a list of resources available for tribes and hosted a webinar this week ahead of the federal government shutdown to discuss tribal funding, Indian affairs, and critical services. Webinar speakers discussed contingency plans, saying most tribal programs will be impacted, which could include funding disruptions. The government shut down midnight on Wednesday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding in part by the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation. You're listening to it here on People Powered KAXE.
This is The Setlist on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at four shows this Friday and Saturday, October 3rd and 4th, in Baxter, Duluth, and Bemidji. First up, Eli Gardner is playing Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter this Friday at 6 p.m. An Americana, gravelly-voiced singer-songwriter who blends folk, rock, and blues with stories of working class and everyday folks. His last album arrived in 2023, but he's released a handful of singles so far this year. Eli Gardner, this Friday, at Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter. On to Saturday for a pair of events in Duluth. First, Dulilith Fest runs from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Chester Bowl Park. Inspired by the Lilith Fair Festival of the 90s, Dulilith Fest features an all-women or non-male identifying lineup, including acclaimed folk singer Galen Lee, rising Americana duo The Penny Peaches, Jerry Small, and many more. 11 to 7 this Saturday in Duluth. Then, Canadian country and western singer Coulter Wall is also playing at 7:30 at the Deck Symphony Hall. Known for his deep voice and Towns Van Zandt-inspired songwriting, Wall has been a leading figure in country music since the mid-teens and recently announced his latest album, Memories and Empties, due out in November. It's Coulter Wall this Saturday at the Deck in Duluth. Finally, there is a punk and metal show late Saturday evening at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji. Four bands are on the lineup, including Bemidji Group's Rotten Sardines playing punk and metal from Noxious Ghoul. Music begins at 9 p.m. at the Folk School, and the event is hosted by Sundown Records. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Coming up from Morning Edition, a remembrance of Jane Goodall, and we're learning more about rising costs and travel. Programming this morning on People Powered KEXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital. They're home to an experienced OBGYN team providing comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. And you can pay nothing to get your old or your damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. If you donate your car, a boat, or other vehicle, it is tax deductible. So you save time, you save money, and it defends the KEXE programs that you love. You can call 855-277-2346 for details or check out our website at kaxe.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Louisville, Kentucky.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. One of the effects of the government shutdown is less insight into the U.S. economy. The next jobs report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics was supposed to come out Friday. That's now delayed. And if the government stays shut down, it would also push back the next report on inflation. NPR has been exploring the impact of inflation in a series called Cost of Living, The Price We Pay. Today, NPR's Joel Rose looks at how many travelers are scaling back plans and staying closer to home.
Emmy Woodbury and her family like Disneyland a lot. Before the COVID pandemic, they used to go three times a year. Now, Woodbury is planning another trip to the happiest place on Earth. And she's struck by how much prices have jumped.
Okay, well, I guess we're not doing that anymore. We'll just go once a year. It'll be fine.
It's not just the price of tickets to the park, says Woodbury, who lives in Santa Clara, California. It's the gas, the restaurants, even hotels.
The hotel rooms are profoundly more expensive than they were before the pandemic. And it's just amazing how fast it's gone up.
The cost of travel is up 20% since 2019, according to government data compiled by the U.S. Travel Association. And that's only part of the story. Travel experts say rising costs across the board are leaving less discretionary income in Americans' pockets.
Things are a little tighter this year. So when you're looking at your spending, relatively speaking, where does travel fit in when you have other expenses?
Lorraine Cilio is a senior analyst at Focusrite, a market research company. She says the industry these days is a tale of two different markets. At the high end, luxury travel is setting records, but lower and middle income vacationers are squeezed. Cilio says they still want to travel, but they're feeling the pain of rising costs.
Americans love to travel, and we all have prioritized experiences. We're prioritized spending time with family and friends. But you'll think a little differently about it. So maybe they're taking shorter trips or more domestic trips. You're thinking of kind of ways to nip away at the spend, but still be able to take the trip.
NPR asked in an online survey how rising costs are affecting Americans' lives. Dozens of people told us they can't afford to go anywhere this year. And many who are traveling say they are dialing back.
With the cost of everything else going up, groceries, power, you name it, just the cost of living has just jumped. And I think everybody's seeing it and everybody's feeling it.
Chris Nagel lives in Battle Creek, Michigan. He'd like to visit his son and grandson in Texas and his sisters who are scattered around the country. But he says the rising costs of pretty much everything have made that impossible. Nagel and his wife are still planning a vacation this fall, but they are not going to Ireland like they originally hoped.
We're taking a trip to Vermont to go hiking and leaf peeping, but we're driving, and the cost was modest compared to going to Ireland, for instance. So we made kind of a value decision there.
Inflation is forcing a lot of travelers to stay closer to home, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
That has been kind of nice. It's really forced us to think a little bit more creatively about some of the places that we might go.
Erin Berryman and her husband live in Fort Collins, Colorado. She says they've been camping in the Rocky Mountains, not in the big campgrounds in famous national parks, but in more secluded spots by the side of gravel roads. Berryman says they found one campsite that is so quiet and off the beaten path that she won't tell us where it is.
I don't know if I'm going to say. I don't want to give it away. No.
Berryman says she and her husband love traveling abroad, too. But for now, they're happy staying in their own scenic backyard. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
In 1960, a 26-year-old began studying chimpanzees in East Africa. She had no higher education in science. Jane Goodall would go on to become one of the best-known scientists and conservationists in the world. She died Wednesday at 91, and as NPR's Nate Rott reports, she inspired generations of scientists hoping to better understand our place in the world.
When Jane Goodall started her long-term study of chimpanzee behavior in Tanzania's Gombe Stream National Park, a study that would make her a household name, her lack of experience was viewed as a good thing, at least in the eyes of her advisor and mentor, the paleoanthropologist Louis Leakey. That's what she told NPR on Morning Edition in an interview in 2021.
Because at that time, the scientific attitude towards animals was so reductionist. You know, only humans had personalities, minds, and emotions. And animals were not sentient beings at all. You shouldn't have empathy with them. Well, I didn't know any of that. I hadn't been told it.
Goodall gave the chimpanzees she was studying names, like Flo, Fifi, and David Greybeard. She interacted with them and quickly started making discoveries about their social structures, how they use tools, how in many ways they weren't all that different from us.
Genetically, we share 98.6% of our DNA with them.
So she did empathize with them.
Jane brought science and caring together.
Thomas Gillespie is a professor and the chair of the Department of Environmental Sciences at Emory University.
She dealt with animal welfare issues as well as conservation issues.
For the past 20-some years, Gillespie worked with Goodall in a collaborative project monitoring the health of chimpanzees and other wildlife in the greater Gombe ecosystem, where Goodall got her start.
So often, I would see Jane and look up to her, and then I would hear from other scientists, well, she's not a real scientist.
But Gillespie says her ability to push through that narrative and communicate science, making it accessible to policymakers and the public, both as a researcher and later in life as an advocate, was part of what made her so special. Her fame didn't hurt either.
Dr. Goodall, I can't thank you enough for saving Lolo.
Lolo, that's what they called her in captivity. But I've given her a new name, one worthy of such a magnificent creature. Popo.
Goodall voiced herself in an episode of The Simpsons in 2019. The toy maker Mattel released a Jane Goodall-themed Barbie in 2022, complete with binoculars and a notebook.
She was able to become, in many ways, the face of Mother Nature.
But perhaps her most enduring legacy is how many people she inspired.
I had always been interested in animal behavior.
Lynn Isbell was in college, wandering around a bookstore when she stumbled on Goodall's book, In the Shadow of Man.
The cover had a young woman with green background of the forest following chimpanzees. And I thought, wow, she kind of looks like me. That's when I decided I wanted to do that kind of work.
Isbell would go on to work in Africa as well and become, for a time, the president of the American Society of Primatologists. And she says one time she met Goodall in Africa and told her how she had been her inspiration.
Of course, I didn't say it very articulately. I was very nervous. But she took it in stride and she just said something like, oh, you don't know how many women have told me this.
Isbell says it was a big moment for her, a small moment for Goodall, and an example of how humble and impactful she was and continues to be. Nate Rott, NPR News.
It's NPR News.
National Public Radio's Morning Edition. You hear it here on KEXE along with local news. We've got the Up North Report coming up next. I'm Heidi Holton with Kari Hedlund on this balmy October 2nd.
It's actually lovely outside right now. But boy, as soon as I walked into the station today, you mentioned earlier to Jeff on the air that we're having some AC issues. On October 2nd, that shouldn't be an issue.
I don't know.
But yesterday, I got to say, I got a little ragey yesterday, Heidi, when I left because I was...
Well, I noticed you were wearing tights.
Well, it's October. I don't care what the weather is. It's October. I should be able to wear tights.
Sweater weather.
Yeah. And then my car was getting fixed. So I was walking home, and yeah. I do this often. It's not a new thing, but just leaving here already hot. And then I go outside and it's just as warm outside out. And with my tights, I was like, and then my phone died. So I couldn't call anyone to come get me.
Well, your father-in-law stopped by after you left and we were laughing. We're like, she's probably home by now.
I was.
Because that's, we know how fast she walks.